Now, with much present, brethren and sisters, that we ask our brother Richard to continue our studies, the fourth parable of Balaam.
Thank you, Brother Mick. My dear brothers and sisters, Balaam is presented to us as very much the rebellious prophet. Let's look at verse 12 of that chapter we read together. And Balaam said unto Balak, "Spake I not also to thy messengers which thou sentest unto me? If Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the commandment of Yahweh to do either good or bad of mine own mind. But what Yahweh saith, that will I speak." He's also, brethren and sisters, very much the irritable prophet. There's a distinct irritation in the words of Balaam here. Irritated because the purpose of Yahweh was so diametrically opposed to his own greed. He would have loved to have relieved Balak of some of his gold and silver. Let's look at verse 13 again. "If Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold." Of course, these words originally occurred when the messengers came to Balaam when he was in the mountains of the east. Turning over to chapter 22, verse 18, "And Balaam said unto the messengers of Balak, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahweh." So this is what's on Balaam's mind. The mere mention of silver and gold, notice those things, only mentioned by Balaam. Balak didn't mention anything about silver and gold, and in such quantities as to fill Balak's house. So we can see what's behind Balaam's thinking. It's the longing Balaam had to go beyond what was decreed for him to do by Yahweh. This longing for silver and gold. And notice the words, "I cannot go beyond the word of Yahweh. I'm not able to go." It was the mere prohibition resting on him that prevented him, causing the children of Israel to receive this curse from him. He would have certainly cursed the children of Israel. There was no inward longing. There was no determination to do what was right, but rather a duty to be performed. And he would have cursed that people which had wandered for 40 years in the desert. He would have cursed a people that would have gone to that land, that needed that land. And why? For his own personal greed and gain. One man's greed versus the welfare of a whole nation. That's this man, Balaam, who is prepared to compromise these words for his own well-being. That people that had wandered 40 years without a home, and he would have been opposed them contrary to the promises, which is inconceivable that he didn't know. Why such a man was chosen, brethren and sisters, to bear such prophecies, such glories of future prosperity for Israel, and the triumphing over Messiah in glory, why such a man was chosen to show these prophecies, it isn't possible to determine with any certainty, although we would like to come back onto that point as we come to the end of the address. After all, it's the message that's important, not the messenger by whom that message is delivered. Verse 14, "And now behold, I go unto my people. Come therefore, and I will advertise thee what this people shall do to thy people in the latter days." Notice, before all else, this was a prophecy relating exclusively to the latter days. Now, there are other nations mentioned down this prophecy here, the latter part of this chapter, which did fall by the wayside before that time came. But nonetheless, it is a prophecy, the burden of which is exclusively for the latter days. It's a latter day prophecy. Let's not make dual applications out of it. Verse 16, "And he saith, and he hath said, which heard the words of God, and knew the knowledge of the Most High, which saw the vision of the Almighty falling, but having his eyes open. Here we are, this idea then of falling, but having his eyes open. The word is actually shut. The one whose eyes had been shut, implying that they are now open. These are titles here, brothers and sisters, which are used in this chapter, titles such as Most High and Almighty. And notice they're used with the word God, which is El. These are titles that we associate with Abraham and the promises and with Melchizedek. You know, brothers and sisters, these things were known to the people, or should we say they weren't unknown to the people round about Israel at this time as they were encamped in the desert. We remember only a few months after this how that Rahab knew how that Yahweh had rescued Israel from Egypt and brought them across the Dead Sea and what he'd done for them in the desert. They knew how that Egypt had been plagued. And it's inconceivable that they didn't know. They didn't know about Melchizedek. They didn't know about the blessing upon Abraham by the greatest man in the world at that time. The future blessing of all nations on Abraham was a fact. This nation was about to enter a land which would have alarmed Egypt, which would have alarmed Assyria. The main highway, as Brother Lane showed us, ran between the two. Was their trade route threatened? Didn't they care? Didn't they know? Of course they knew, brothers and sisters. Their intelligence was good. They knew what was behind the power of this nation. Let's look back at chapter 23 and verse 21. He hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. Yahweh his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. And also verse 23. Surely there is no enchantment against Jacob, neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? They were a great people, a great nation. We'll be coming back indeed into some of those words a little later. They may be the answer to a question that we've already posed. We see that there, and it is a play on the change of Jacob's name. Brother Dennis mentioned this. And what was the significance then of this? It mentioned, you see, herein he's mentioning his Balaam, the change of the name from Jacob to Israel. And what is the significance for them of these things? The one who had received the birthright and the blessing and the promises. His name was changed. Jacob the unblessed, Israel the blessed. You know, brothers and sisters, these things weren't done in a corner. And yet from the remoteness of history in which we look at these things, we sometimes think they were. These things are well known. Balaam had good, general and divinely specific knowledge of the people of Yahweh, and furthermore he knew the nature of Israel's God, as we shall see. I'd just like to put the first overhead up because we want to come back onto this point of the use of titles in this verse 16. Notice that the title El stands at the head of the other two titles, Most High and Almighty. And therefore, in this verse, we have El Elyon and El Shaddai. El Elyon and El Shaddai. The Most High El and Almighty Power. Compare the first then with Genesis chapter 14. Shall we just turn over to Genesis 14 and see the first use of this title? Genesis 14 and verse 18, and you will know the context very well, brethren and sisters. Context needs no explanation. It's the appearance of Melchizedek to bless Abraham. Chapter 14 and verse 18. and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High El. He came to bless Abraham. Notice he first how Melchizedek is associated with the title. It's, as we said, it's the first use of this title. There's no, the covenant name isn't associated with Melchizedek. He doesn't use it, and it isn't used in connection with him. Abraham uses it. Melchizedek does not. Not the covenant name. Verse 19, and he blessed him, that is Abraham, and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High El, possessor of heaven and earth. And he blessed, and blessed be the Most High El, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand. And he gave him tithes of all. He blessed, first of all, Abraham, and then he blessed El Elyon. And can we see by these things, he's the true mediator. He's the one that stands in the middle. He's the one greater than the bearer of the promises. And therefore, he represents one and the order of one who is greater than the promises themselves. And verse 22, and Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto Yahweh El Elyon, the possessor of heaven and earth. Notice here, in deference to this great man, how Abraham, though he was one who called upon Yahweh, he does there in that verse. He uses the words El Elyon. Nowhere else does Abraham use it. Well, the other title is much more associated with the promises themselves. Can we turn over to Genesis chapter 17? Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am Almighty God, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be thou perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Notice the word then, El Shaddai. Again, this is the first use of this title, and it's associated with the blessing upon Abraham. Verse 5, neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be called Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. This is the grace of Yahweh demonstrated to all nations. And notice that this grace that's offered to him here, the word Abram, from the word Ram, we saw the word Ram as part of the word Aram yesterday, means Aram means an exalted plane. The word Ram means exalted, one high, one exalted. So Abram means father of exaltation. His name was changed to Avraham, multitude. And in Hebrew, the name Abram is a four-letter word. Abraham is a five-letter word. And the name Abraham is formed by adding to it the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is the number 5. So you can see how the grace surrounding Abraham at this time. And those are the words there that we read. They're worth looking at, aren't they? Hebrews, Genesis chapter 17, the Hebrew is quite clear to us. Verse 7 and 8. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant. Notice that everlasting covenant. Livrit Olam, a covenant of the Olam, that hidden period to come. And he goes on to say, doesn't he, to be a God unto them and unto thy seed after thee. And verse 8, and I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Lahozat olam. For a possession of the olam, that hidden period. These are the blessings associated with those titles that Balaam has used here. And so what does this king of Moab and Midian, or associated with the princes of Midian, hope to gain, that he has sought to overthrow the purpose of El Elyon, of El Shaddai, and the covenant people of God. These things, brothers, as we say again, were not done in a corner. He was not afraid to devise evil against those, this one, that nation who have received the promises, that have received the blessing from Melchizedek. And what does Balaam think he's about, that he can defy Israel's God? Let's turn back to Numbers chapter 24. Verse 17. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Shet. We come very rapidly, brothers and sisters, to the climax of this confrontation, this final confrontation between Balak and Balaam. It's the catastrophe of the plot. It says, I see him. If we just change it slightly, we think the words probably could be translated slightly differently. I see him and he is not now. I behold him and he is not nigh. I see him and he is not now. I behold him and he is not nigh. This was most definitely, in other words, a future import, although Balaam saw it at hand. That's what he's saying. I see him, and he's not now. I can behold him, and he's not near. It was for the future that Balaam was speaking, although, as we say, he saw it at hand. And this king, this rising star, the scepter bearer, shall smite, as it says, the corners or the sides of Moab. And shall destroy Moab. Let's just look at what he's saying here. That phrase there that we read, all the children of Sheth, or the sons of Shet. Now we could treat this as just a tribal family within Moab. We think of the glories of this prophecy that we have here before us, brothers and sisters. It would be greatly restricting such a glorious prophecy, restrict it to a family within Moab. Kol Bene Shet, all the sons of tumult, from the Hebrew shatah. It's not a very well used root. In fact, it took some finding, but Davidson suggests that it means tumult, drunkenness, riot, even destruction. So we see here that they will destroy. Who will they destroy? They'll destroy all the sons of tumult that rise up against them. This is the play on the word Shet. Indeed, it was a family within Moab, but it has wider implications. And we learn more of this from the Apocalypse. Let's turn over to Apocalypse chapter 2 and look at verse 26. Chapter 2 and verse 26. Here he's speaking to the ecclesia at Thyatira, and he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received them my Father. And I will give him the morning star. And he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the ecclesias. Notice there then, brothers and sisters, the idea of the star that we read in verse 17 of Numbers 24. It's the same as we read in Numbers, the star is associated with the destruction of Messiah's enemies, the sons of tumult. And notice there, he says, he shall rule the nations with a rod of iron. We'll be coming back onto that in a moment. The rod of iron. It might just pay us here just to turn back into Numbers 24 for a moment. We're coming straight back into the Apocalypse. Just look at verse 17 again, because it says, the star shall rise out of Jacob, a scepter shall rise out of Israel and shall smite the sides of Moab and destroy all the children of Shet. Notice that scepter. It's the same word as the word rod. Let's look back at then at chapter 2. Let's look at those verses again. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers. And here he's alluding, we suggest, to Psalm 2. Even as I received of my father, and I will give him the morning star. Ever the symbol of the resurrection. Let's turn over to chapter 22 of the Apocalypse. Chapter 22. And verse 16. I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the ecclesias, and I am the root and the offspring of David, and the bright and the morning star. Once again, we see this idea of the star, that this idea of the rising dawn, ever a symbol of the resurrection, the morning star. That's why it's the star out of Jacob, the morning star. Now, Venus is the morning star, brothers and sisters. It's the herald of the day. Its orbit is very close to the sun. It can only be seen early in the morning. This is Jesus. He's the star which is seen. It's herald, the herald of the day, the bringing forth of the day. The morning star who shall raise the dead and, as we said, destroy the sons of tumult. Let's turn back then into Psalm 2. Psalm 2, verse 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. This is why do the heathen rage? Why do they tumultuously assemble? It's not the same word as tumult as we get there, brothers and sisters, but the idea is it's a similar idea being put before us. They rage, they assemble together for tumult. The kings have set themselves together, the rulers take counsel together. What have we got? On the mountains of Moab, the rulers taking counsel together against his anointed, against the people of his pleasure, and of his choosing. Notice the word anointed there is the word Messiah. Verse 8, ask of me and I shall give thee the heathen, the goyim, for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. He will dispossess his enemies when he smites the sides of Moab and prevails against the tumultuous ones. And did you remember, brothers and sisters, when we looked at Apocalypse chapter 22, verse 16, we won't look back, he was also the root and the offspring of David. Why the root and the offspring of David? Of course, he is both son of man and he is Son of God. He is the root of David because he is the one born by the Eternal Spirit from the beginning. And how can he be both the root of David and the offspring, the shoot out of the side, or the branch out of the stem of Jesse? Because he was also Son of Man, Son of God, and Son of Man. Notice also in this psalm, brothers and sisters, we have the idea of the rod once again. The rod. He will dispossess his enemies with the rod. The word rod in this psalm is the Hebrew shebet. It's the same word translated scepter in Numbers 24 and verse 17. It's the rod and it's the scepter. It's the rod of authority. You know, brethren and sisters, if there's anything that the nations need, especially our modern society, it's an authoritarian rod. which can be turned to a rod of judgment as and when required, a rod of correction by which the Son himself learnt obedience through his sufferings. Let's turn back to 2 Samuel in chapter 7. 2 Samuel 7, words that we know very well, words that you may have had to quote when you were interviewed for baptism. 2 Samuel 7 and verse 14. I will be to him for a father, and he shall be to me for a son. The word if isn't there, brothers. There's nothing conditional about the son's sufferings whatsoever. The word isn't if, it's the word who in. And the word iniquity there is the word avot, not the word avon. It's the word avot. It means to twist or distort. It means to pervert. And it's used that way in Scripture. We haven't got time to do a study of that word tonight, brothers and sisters, but this word avot, it doesn't quite mean iniquity. The word avon, which is from the same root, means iniquity. So what he's saying? Who, in his subversion, in the perversion, that is, of his right, in the subversion of his justice, we think of his trial, his mockery of a trial, and the assembly of the wicked against him. In his subversion, I will chasten with the rod or the scepter of Ish and with the wounds of the sons of Adam. So can we see, brothers and sisters, he was afflicted by the determinate counsel and the wickedness of men. The rod of Ish and with the wounds of the sons of Adam. Those things that came upon him because he was in sin's flesh. There's that word rod there. Is again the word shebet, scepter. He had the rod of correction before he took the scepter of rulership. And so he is the one that triumphed over the rod of human wickedness and will yet triumph over his enemies. His people shall triumph with him over their enemies. And this is the burden, of course, of Jeremiah chapter 51. Let's turn over with me, would you please, to Jeremiah 51. This isn't the only use of this phrase. It's used on several occasions. This one happens to suit our purposes tonight. Jeremiah 51, and we'll look at verse 19. Or speaking of the idols of the wicked for connection, verse 18, they are vanity, the work of errors. In the time of their visitation they shall perish. The portion of Jacob is not like them, for he is the former of all things, and Israel is the rod of his inheritance. Yahweh of hosts is his name. The word Israel isn't there. And the rod of his inheritance, and Yahweh of hosts is his name. Notice then from here how the rod is the word shebet, and he has himself become the rod and scepter to his people. He is their portion. He is of shebet nechlato, and the rod of his inheritance. He is the rod, and he will be the scepter of their inheritance in that day. Verse 20. Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, the Goyim, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms, and with thee will I break in pieces the horse and his rider, and with thee will I break in pieces the chariot and his rider. These are the same nations that Jeremiah is speaking about here. They're differently described, that were mentioned by Balaam. You know, and preeminently, brethren and sisters, we must turn to Genesis 49. The following verse, in fact, from that which we looked at with Brother Dennis earlier this afternoon. Genesis 49 and the blessings upon Judah. For 49 verse 10, he says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, and one, a young one to lead on in their future generations. They won't depart from between his feet until Shiloh come. And to him shall the gathering of the people be. Not until he comes shall the gathering of the people be. So the gathering of the nations, the gathering of the tribes rather, to Israel, to him, is that work which is yet future. The scepter that won't depart from Judah in that day. And so, brothers and sisters, these are the things which preeminently we see from Numbers 24 and verse 17. So Balaam begins his prophetic judgments on the nations. We must proceed fairly swiftly. Balaam begins his prophetic judgments upon the nations round about. He says, "And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall do valiantly." Notice the use of the word there, Edom, and the word Seir. Why does he say that? Why the significance of the ancient name for that land to which Edom and his descendants had for their inheritance? They were promised the desert and the rocky regions, as we saw from Brother Lane's address yesterday. Thus they received. Why does he then use the word Seir? Again, not easy to be dogmatic, but the ancient name we suggest is being used here because this land is going to be possessed by Israel. We know from the latter chapters of Ezekiel that this is the case. This land shall be possessed by Israel as though Esau never existed. Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste. And his heritage is waste, brothers and sisters. It shall be kept for them, for the righteous. And it shall be absorbed into the land of Israel in that day. Let's look at this idea then of Esau a little further, because why is he, or Edom, why is he mentioned here? We take it that the name Esau here stands for Israel's enemies in general, and not just that which was the descendant of Esau. Can we just turn over just for a moment into Obadiah's prophecy? Obadiah. It follows Amos, and it's before Jonah. You know, brothers and sisters, this is a prophecy all about Edom. And we know by the very terms of this prophecy, it can't relate only to Edom. Let's begin by looking at verse 18, then, of Obadiah's prophecy. "And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it." None remaining. "And they of the south." These are the blessings upon Israel. This is how they possess. "They of the south shall possess the mount of Esau, and they of the plain the Philistines, and they shall possess the fields of Ephraim, and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath. And the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south." And when this happens, saviors shall come up upon Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be Yahweh's. So Esau is to be annihilated. Is it only Esau that we have mentioned here, brothers and sisters? We don't think so. Esau, for the old hatred, had done these things mentioned in the early part of Obadiah's prophecy, but they were symptomatic of the wicked who hate Yahweh's purpose per se and his people. Verse 15, for the day of Yahweh is near upon all the heathen, the nations, the Goyim. So we mustn't restrict the idea of Esau or Edom in prophecy only to the sons of Esau. Near upon all the heathen, as thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. And verse 16, for as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the Goyim drink continually. Yea, they shall drink and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. They shall be as though they had not been. That's why we suggest, brothers and sisters, that Esau is mentioned with Seir, the ancient name for his land, as though he had not been. The wicked are to be taken away from before the face of Yahweh. Let's turn back to Numbers 24, shall we, and look at verse 19. Out of Jacob shall he come, shall he that shall have dominion. Start again. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of the city. Well, this has relation to the manner of the battle campaign to be waged by Yahweh and his people in that day, as he fought in the day of battle, quoting the words from Zechariah 14. Following the type of Joshua's campaigns, who first defeated his enemies in battle and then hunted the fugitives that had escaped to fenced cities. In fact, on one occasion in Joshua, they tried to prevent them escaping through the gap into the western, into the plain of Esdraelon, to prevent them escaping into fenced cities. Let's just turn on into Joshua chapter 10 for a moment to see that this is the case. This is how Yahweh fought in the day of battle. Joshua chapter 10. And verse 10. Here, the Gibeonites have complained to Joshua that the multitude of these five kings have come against him, have come against their city, and because of the covenant of Joshua with the Gibeonites, have sent for his help. Verse 10. And Yahweh discomfited them before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth up to Beit Horon, and smote them unto Atzekah and unto Makkedah. Oh, and yes, verse 11. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel and were in the going down to Beit Horon, that Yahweh cast down great stones from heaven upon them unto Atzekah, and they died. They were more which died with the hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. Later in this chapter, we see how Joshua then sent from city to city to slay the remnant of them that had escaped him in battle. Just as an example, we see in verse 28. And that day Joshua took Makkedah and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof he utterly destroyed. Them and all the souls that were therein, he let none remain. And he did to the king of Makkedah as he did unto the king of Jericho. You know, brothers and sisters, it wasn't without reason that Balak sent for Balaam to come and curse this people. They knew what was in store. It so happened, brothers and sisters, that Moab was preserved. Yahweh would give them none of their inheritance at that time. But they knew, brothers and sisters, what was in store for them. That's how Yahweh fought for Israel in the day of battle. And take notice of verses 8 and 9 before we leave this chapter. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand. There shall not a man of them stand before thee. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night. You see, he was encamped in the Jordan Valley at Gilgal, and he ascended all night. He ascended over the Judean hills. What would that be? There are those of you that know the land well. 20, 25 miles, forced, marched his people overnight. And he came on them suddenly. You see, his enemies thought that Joshua was too remote. They thought he couldn't reach them. Let's be warned, brothers and sisters. Be warned about these things. Because the things that we're expecting are not remote. They're at hand. They're ready to come. His enemies thought that Joshua was too remote, that he couldn't deal with them. And he came upon them suddenly, as a thief, in the grey of dawn, and took them all away. Let's turn back to Numbers chapter 24, look at verse 20. And he looked on the Kenites, and took up his parable, and said, "Strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock." We saw from the address yesterday given to us by Brother Lane how the word nest there is the word Ken. It's a play on the word Kenite, as he showed us. The Kenites, Moses' father-in-law was a Kenite. The Rechabites of the days of Jeremiah were Kenites. Jael, the wife of Heber, who slew Sisera at the time of Deborah and Barak, she was a Kenite. The Kenites were advised to depart from their normal camp by Saul in his abortive attempt to slay the Amalekites. So the Kenites were, we would suggest, were a Semitic race from Shem. Some commentators have said that they came from Abraham's wife Keturah. This is impossible because they're mentioned in Genesis chapter 15, which predates that union. But certainly they dwelled closely with Israel for many centuries. And what does it say about them? Literally, it says... And Edom shall be a possession, Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall do that. Out of Jacob shall come him that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that reigneth the city. And when he looked on Amalek, we've gone a little bit too far when we've mentioned the Kenites. But it says that they will be taken away by Asher in that day. That when the time when Asher will come down, he will take away the Kenites. Let's look at the verse 19. There's the one that shall come to destroy Amalek. Verse 20. When he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, "Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever." Let's look back then at verse 21. Literally, the beginning of the Goyim is Amalek. The beginning of the Goyim, the nations. That is, the first of the nations who came against Israel when they were weak-handed in the wilderness and came and slew the hindermost of them. The first of those who sought then to annihilate them. This was the grandson of Esau. Amalek was descended from Esau. Esau was a desert dweller. His hand was against Jacob. He was a man who would live by the sword, whose habitation would be the desert. And this is certainly what we see of Amalek, truly a son of Esau. His name means warlike. There's a cognate Hebrew word. It's the word malcham. Yahweh ish milchama. Yahweh is a man of war. And so the word Amalek means warlike. And the force of the words in verse 7 are clear to us. If you look back at verse 7, he shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Notice then, the force of these words are very apparent here, brothers and sisters. Agag being a dynasty within Amalek, and it was seen, was it not, at the time of Samuel. Samuel slew Agag, he hewed him in pieces before Yahweh. Agag was seen at the time of Esther, Haman the Agagite. And he is mentioned here, Agag. He is certainly the annihilator of God's people, or the would-be annihilator of God's people. And he is then in type that he will perish forever. The Goyim were, it says, identified then from the beginning. He was the first of the Goyim that came against Israel, but the Goyim were identified from the beginning, from Genesis chapter 10. Can we look back, turn back then to Genesis chapter 10, and let's spend a few minutes there. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 2. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras. And the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarma. And the sons of Javan, Elishar and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. And it says, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. These are the warlike Goyim to be destroyed upon the mountains of Israel in the valley of Hamon Gog. Ezekiel chapter 39:11. You know, there's a similarity of language here, is there not, brothers and sisters? We've not made a full investigation of these words as yet, or we would have had an overhead slide to show you, but there is a similarity between Hamon Gog and Hamon Agagite, Haman the Agagite. Hamon and Haman can be seen to be developed from similar roots. We haven't finally made our own investigations of these things, but we put this for you as an idea that Hamon Gog and Hamon the Agagite are similar ideas, the multitude of Gog and Haman the Agagite who sought to slay the Israelites, who sought to slay the Jews at the time of Esther. And the similarity of the Agagite and Hamon Gog is too close to put down to mere coincidence. And whether or not Haman was indeed truly an Amalekite makes no difference. He's portrayed in the word as the annihilator of Yahweh's people, and on that account alone he is an Agagite. And we think of the words of David when we look down this list here in Genesis chapter 10. We see there in verse 2, Magog and Madai, Javan and Tubal, Gomer, Meshech and Tiras. David's words, woe is me that I dwell in Meshech. I dwell with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. And so Balaam saw Amalek in spirit, themselves destroyed forever. Let's just turn back a moment to, we'll be coming back into Genesis 10 in a moment or so. But let's just turn back to Numbers 24 for a moment. Because it says in verse 20, when he looked upon Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever. He saw Amalek in spirit, brother and sister. He saw the end of Amalek forever, that he should perish. Ade obed. Perpetual extinction. Ade obed. Perpetual extinction. Just as Abraham saw Israel in spirit, inheriting northward and southward and eastward and westward, as we read in Genesis 15. Amalek would perish, as this vision shows, and Israel would expand to all the points of the compass. In fact, a tract of land which included the territory of the next mentioned tribe, which we were a little bit previous in looking down at. Our eyes unfortunately flick down to the next verse. We've mentioned then the Kenites. We don't want to go into what we said earlier again, but let's just say this, that they were, as we said, we think they were related from the Shemites, that they were not a Canaanitish race, and indeed, as we said, they were mentioned in Genesis chapter 15. And indeed they will be absorbed into the land of Israel when the promises shall be fulfilled. Verse 22, nevertheless, the Kenites shall be wasted, and Asher shall carry thee away captive. or what it, we think a better translation is, therefore, the Cainy shall not be destroyed until Asher shall carry them away captive. And so when Asher came down into the land, when the Assyrian came into the land of Israel and Judah, they were taken away. They were taken away. Verse 23. And he took up his parable and said, "Alas, who shall live when God doeth this? And the ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and shall afflict Assyria, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall perish forever." You know, brothers and sisters, Heber here represents the descendants of Shem. We suggest to you that it doesn't represent the descendants, the Hebrews. Doesn't represent the Hebrews, but the descendants of Shem. Can we turn back into Genesis chapter 10? Let's look at verse 32. In fact, let's look at verse 21 first. Here we have the line through Shem. "And to Shem also, the father of all the children of Heber, the brother of Japheth the elder, and to him were the children born, the children of Shem, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram." Those nations, some of those nations we've already seen in this study, Aram and Asher, Syria and Assyria. Verse 25, "And unto Heber were born two sons, the name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan." And the rest of that genealogy goes down and it lists the heathen through Joktan, that which was in confederate with Nimrod, the one whose name means "we will rebel." And look at their association, these sons of Shem. Verse 32. "These are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations in their goyim. And by these were the Goyim divided in the earth after the flood." So this whole line of Shem through Joktan is associated with the heathen. And you know, the Tower of Babel incident in chapter 11 is dropped like a wedge between the two givings of the genealogy of Shem, because it occurs again in chapter 11. This line of Shem, from verse 10 onwards, "These are the generations of Shem," and it comes down to Peleg, and Joktan is not mentioned at all. And it comes down the patriarchal line, and comes down to Terah and Abraham, the line of the patriarchs. That line of patriarchs that preserved the Hebrew tongue because they were separate from the rebellion of Nimrod. Indeed, archaeological findings in Tel Mardik or Ebla demonstrate that, in fact, northern Syria was, in fact, the preservation area, the homeland of the Hebrew tongue. Much, we might say, to the annoyance of the Syrian government, who, for a long time, prevented any further excavations. And so, brothers and sisters, these are the Goyim to be destroyed. These are the nations, the beginning of the nations. Nations from the beginning were mentioned, those that are going to be destroyed on the mountains of Israel. Let's turn back into Numbers and look at verse 25. But let's look at verse 24 first. Seen this slide before, brothers and sisters. It was kindly lent to us by Brother Ken Smith. Verse 24, "And the ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Heber, and these also shall perish forever." These also shall perish forever. What he's saying here then, these mighty empires out of the east would eventually be conquered from the west. And we're talking here, brothers and sisters, about the head of gold and the breast and the arms of silver passing away and being taken over by the brazen Greeks and the iron legs of Rome, the brass and the iron. And of those latter two, Kittim, or Cyprus, was the limit of their visibility and the limit of their experience at this time. As we can see here, Cyprus, Kittim, which indeed can be seen from the coast, the northern coast of Lebanon, the coasts of Israel. You can see Kittim in the distance. This would be the limit of their understanding of the West. This is why Kittim is mentioned here, brothers and sisters. There's that of Yafet or Japheth beyond Kittim, that which belonged to those Western nations yet to come to light at this time. This was the limit then of their experience. There was that of Japheth beyond the unknown Western horizon, beyond the frontier of their knowledge at this time. That which may not even have been developed ethnically at this time. And so we can see then the scope and the scale of these prophecies, brothers and sisters, the sheer scope of it all. It was enormous. The distance in time that Balaam predicted, the taking away of these vast empires of the east, these empires of the Shemite race, that when they were demolished by the empires of the west, the Shemites would never rise again until the time of the end. It would be dominated by the sons of Japheth. And so it has been all down the ages until today. But there's a time coming when the sons of Shem will be manifested once again in the earth as the greatest of the nations. Verse 25, and Balaam rose up and went and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. Balaam was slain by Israel. He had returned, brothers and sisters, to Balak when Israel slew the Midianites. This contemptible, greedy, corrupt, devious Balaam was justly slain by the people he so desperately would have liked to have cursed. He would have seen destroyed for his own gain. Although we don't learn the reason for this until the apocalypse. Could we turn to Revelation chapter 2? We would actually like to look in at Jude on the way. The Epistle of Jude and verse 11. We find this remarkable. This is something enigmatic, brothers and sisters. Woe unto them, for they have... These are the enemies of the Ecclesia. Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain. They have run greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Can we see that Balaam here, brothers and sisters, is numbered with Cain and is numbered with Korah? Arch rebellion. That's Balaam with Cain and with Korah. Balaam, who would have seen Israel destroyed, who would have perverted the way of justice, would have demolished the promises, would have overturned the blessing of Melchizedek. This is Balaam. Apocalypse chapter 2 and verse 14. This is what he says to the Ecclesia at Pergamos. I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, and to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. There's an enigma about all this, isn't there, brothers and sisters, why such a man was chosen to give forth these glorious prophecies. And we think there is an answer. We think the answer is this. There's no divination against Israel. There's no enchantment against them. There's no power on earth can overturn the promises that God made to the people so long ago, to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. He's demonstrating by Balaam. He's a representative of all that's rebellious and wicked amongst the Goyim. And they won't overturn the purpose of Yahweh. Rather will he turn about the madness of the prophet, the dumbass speaking with man's voice. It's a strange quirk of the English language, brethren and sisters, that while the ass spoke eloquently with man's voice, all Balaam could say was nay. But notice what Balaam has done. He's gone back to Balak and he's taught him how to make Israel bring the curse upon themselves. You know why he can do this, brothers and sisters? It's because he has a knowledge of the nature of Israel's God. He knows that he is a God who is holy and without respect of persons and will be sanctified in those who draw near. And he's used the daughters of Midian, the attractive semi-clad daughters of Midian, to lure the young men of Israel to their idolatrous, wicked practices so that they might bring the curse upon themselves. He returned of his own volition that he might take the reward. Balaam went to his own country. The Hebrew is quite emphatic that we read there in Numbers. For those of you that are interested, it seems to be vav consecutive. He went and returned to his own place. Finally, brothers and sisters, we'd like to turn to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. And verse 1. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. The contempt of the Olam, the life of the Olam. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars for ever and ever. They themselves are as the stars. They are with the one who is the star out of Jacob. They shine as the stars of the firmament, brothers and sisters, in that day. Notice the word wise there. They're the maskilim. See that word maskil at the head of the Psalms. They're the instructed ones. Those that instruct and are themselves.